In the song that we just sang, written by Isaac Watts in 1707, the words were anyway, that song contains in it most of what the Lord's Supper is really about. I realize that it's uninspired, but it's something that is spiritual in nature and certainly has a lot of good teaching in it. When I survey the wondrous cross on which the Prince of Glory died, my richest gain I count but loss and pour contempt on all my pride. Forbid it, Lord, that I should boast, save in the death of Christ my Lord. All the vain things that charm me most, I sacrifice them to his blood. The reason why the Lord's Supper is so important is because it focuses our minds on the one thing that's going to get us into eternity. What the opening two lines of that song talk about are the fact that as we survey the wondrous cross, which is what we do during the communion, we survey it, we think about it in our minds, we look at it, we think about the cross. And as we do that, it forces us to reflect upon ourselves, in which we think about, well, my richest gain, the greatest things that I've done, whatever it is that I've accomplished in this life, nothing. And pour contempt on all my pride. All the things that I'm proud of, all the things I've accomplished, they're nothing. Because when we get to the other side, we have to practice this now. But when we get to the other side, and we stand before God, it's not going to be about, look at all the great things I did. Look at how much money I had. Look how much glory I had. Look how much I accomplished. You're not going to stand before God and say that to him, are you? The only boast that you're going to have when you get to the other side is you're going to say that, well, I was important enough for Jesus to die for me. That's what you're going to say. That's my only boast. He died for me. And that's what's going to get us into eternity. And we need to practice that now. And that's part of what the communion is intended to remind us of. In 1 Corinthians chapter 11, Paul explains the importance of the Lord's Supper. And I want to talk about that this morning. Why it's important that we commune with Christ and with each other in the breaking of bread. Paul talks about, first of all, the communion, the Lord's Supper, as a coming together. And he rebukes them because when they come together to eat it, and that's assuming that we come together, that's a fundamental, that's the first step in the Lord's Supper, is come together. Get together, be in the same place, and then we can talk about the Lord's Supper. But Paul says, well, you're coming together, but it's not to eat the Lord's Supper. It should have been, but it wasn't, because everybody's taking their own supper. And I'm not going to talk about social fellowship is important, and we'll talk about that in some other day in some other context. But the point here is the bigger issue is that they're mixing the sacred and the secular. And they're not taking the sacred and treating it sacred. They're not understanding why they came together. I don't want to ask the question this morning, why do saints come together at all? Why cannot Christianity simply be practiced individually, privately, and secretly, or not even secretly, but just on your own, with no coming together at all? Why do we need the church at all? Maybe, David, that's another lesson. You can add that to the list of lessons. Why do we need the church at all? Well, the communion is one of the reasons why we need the church, because it's something we're told to do, to come together. And so, when we come together, part of what we're doing in the communion is communing with each other. I'm sharing that faith with you. You're sharing it with me. I am encouraged by your presence, and hopefully you are encouraged by my presence, because knowing that there are this many people in this small community who are interested in remembering the death of Jesus, that matters to me, and it matters to you. And it builds up our faith because we're sharing that together. We talked about this a little bit Wednesday night, the fact that in ancient cultures, and in many cultures today, unfortunately not America, but we've kind of lost that with the drive-through. Our culture invented that. There's no drive-through in the first century. In the first century, when people ate meals together, they sat down together, spent time together. It was family, and it was friends, and you made bonds of friendship and family during those lengthy meals. And that's part of the reason why I think that consuming food is part of what Christians did, consuming the bread and the cup in the Lord's Supper, not as a social meal. Paul rules that out. Social meals are fine, but not here. But consuming food is symbolic of eating a meal together. And eating a meal together was a bond that brought people together. They communed with each other by eating food together. And that food was symbolic of Christ, but it symbolized the fact that they were a family and they came together. That's why Christians come together at all, and that's why they come together for the Lord's Supper. And one of the problems that Paul points out here in the Corinthian church is the fact that they've mixed the sacred and the secular, improperly mixed it together. The secular needs to be somewhere else. This hour that we have together, and we've designated it as 11 to 12 in the morning, but whatever time it is, whatever it may be, in whichever assembly you happen to be in, for us, this time, 11 to 12, on the first day of the week, is not just any hour, it's not just any time. What happens during this hour, in this time and place, and we've shied away from using this term, but I think we need to bring it back, it's holy. This time and place is holy, it's sacred. Because look at all the things that we aren't doing during this hour right now. You know, if David had got up there and led the song Eleanor Rigby by the Beatles, we're all going to sing that this morning. I got up and said, oh, wait a minute, David, let's cross that off the list. That's not, we're going to sing that. If I got up here and gave a speech about the NFL draft picks that are coming up, I think Mike would get up here and say, well, wait a minute, Vance, that's not what we're here to talk about. All right? We're not here to talk about, to sing secular music. We're not here to talk about sports or entertainment. If I gave you a speech on how to make $100 in real estate next year, you would stop me, I hope, because that's not what we're here for. We're not here to talk about the stock market or how to, any of that stuff. That's all, and it's not wrong to listen to the Beatles. It's not wrong to make money in the stock market. It's not wrong to talk about NFL draft picks, but not here and not now. This hour is sacred. And what is it sacred and holy? It's dedicated to something. That's what the word sacred and holy mean. It means they're set apart and dedicated. Dedicated to God. Dedicated to remembering Jesus. And so this hour and this place has to be dedicated to those things and nothing else. Everything else gets left outside. You can talk about that stuff out in the parking lot. You can talk about it some other hour, but not now and not here. And that's what Paul wants to realize. Get that sense of the sacred and the holy. And preserve it during this time period when we commune with each other for this purpose. And we can commune with each other for secular purposes in other times and places. Because when we commune together, it's not only communion with each other, it's also communion with Christ. In a spiritual and some figurative or spiritual sense, Christ is here too. In 1 Corinthians 10 and verse 16, Paul writes just a chapter earlier, the cup of blessing which we bless, is it not the communion of the blood of Christ? The bread which we break, is it not the communion of the body of Christ? For we, though many, are one bread and one body, for we all partake of that one bread. Wherever you have the body has a head, right? The body can't be somewhere that the head isn't. Where the body is, you'll find the head. Jesus is the head. We're the body. We commune with him when we commune in the Lord's Supper. The cup which we bless, it's communion of the blood of Christ. We're communing with him, participating in, thinking about, and celebrating the fact that his blood was given for us. And the bread is communion of his body. It means that we associate ourselves to that body that was given. We think about it and we trust in it, and we thank him for it. For we, though many, are one bread and one body. We all partake of that one bread. Eating that communion together helps join us together as a family, as a body of people. And by sharing that time and space together, we come together and become one body. That's what makes us one body. Is that joining and fellowship together. You know, there are a lot of things that if you were to list all the things that interest us, or whatever our political beliefs may be, or our sports team preferences, or whatever that may, whatever that, you'll get all kinds of diversities of opinion. If we tried to find a reason for this group of people to come together that was anything other than Christ, I don't think we'd be able to do it. We wouldn't be able to do it on the basis of economic association, because I'm sure we have a broad diversity of economic status. We couldn't do it on the basis of education. We have a diversity of educational levels. We couldn't do it on the basis of occupational things, because we have a wide diversity of that. We couldn't do it on the basis of politics, because we have a diversity of political views. But none of those things are what unite us at all, and couldn't possibly. What unites us is the fact that we all partake of the one bread and the one body of Christ. We're all seeking after Him and trying to commune with Him. And that's what brings us together and holds us together, is that common faith in Christ. At the same time that we commune with each other and we commune with the Lord, 1 Corinthians 11:23 talks about the importance of it and goes back to the night that Jesus was betrayed. And before His betrayal, He ate that Passover meal with the apostles. And in so doing, Jesus talked about the fact that this bread and the fruit of the vine were going to be used in His kingdom in remembrance of Him. And I'm sure the apostles had trouble understanding that, because why would they need to remember Him? After all, He's right here. Where is He going? He's not going to be around. And there had been some questions about that in the discussion. Read the Gospel of John. There's discussion about, well, He's going somewhere. Well, where is He going? And why can't we follow Him? And all that. They don't understand. They would later. 1 Corinthians 11:23 says, "For I received from the Lord that which also I also delivered to you, that the Lord Jesus, on the same night in which He was betrayed, took bread. When He had given thanks, He broke it and said, 'Take, eat, this is My body, which is broken for you. Do this in remembrance of Me.' In the same manner, He also took the cup after supper, saying, 'This cup is the new covenant in My blood. This do as often as you drink it in remembrance of Me.'" This may be something, a defect of those of us who have male chromosomes. I don't know. There's some kind of thing in our minds that blocks remembrance of dates and events. Just ask any married guy if he's got a really good memory for anniversaries and birthdays and stuff. You know what I'm talking about, guys. Ladies, you know what I'm talking about. I don't go into Harris Teeter as often as I used to, but every time I do, while I'm walking down the aisles, I always stop and think, now, is there an anniversary or birthday coming up that I need to buy a card for? And I'll say, it's, you know, July. I got 3 birthdays in July, and then there's an anniversary in May. And what date is this? And then somebody else's birthday. And how close are we? And should I buy something? And I just can't remember all that stuff for the life of me. I try. I really do, but I'm not very good at remembering it. And it's not that I don't care about those people. I do care about them. I just can't remember all those dates and all that stuff. And so it's not the lack of importance of those people in my life. It's just the frailness of humanity or the male chromosomes or whatever it is. It's some kind of frailness that causes us to forget things, even things that are important that we ought to remember. And I think the Lord knew that when He set up a memorial to His death and His body and blood, when He said, "Do this in remembrance of Me." He wanted something that people could use on a regular basis to remember Him, so they didn't forget. They didn't forget His body and blood, didn't forget His crucifixion. Because we're baptized into Christ, and that's a wonderful thing, and we have zeal, we're excited about Christ, we're excited about our salvation, and that's good, we should be. But time passes, and zeal cools off, and memories fade. And here's what else happens. Life happens. All that stuff, people in the first century were busy, and we're even busier. You know why we're busier? Because we have more technology. It allows us to cram more things into our lives. We have time-saving, labor-saving devices, so we plan more things to do because we have more things that can do more things. Okay, we don't just say, "Hey, everything's done, so now I can take leisure." No, we don't. Stuff's done, so now I can plan more. We fill our days with more stuff. It's not a sin to be busy. That's just life. But when life gets busy, we still have to take that time to stop what we're doing and commune with the Lord. And that's why the Lord's Supper exists. So that at the very minimum, and I hope we remember the death of Jesus more than once a week. I hope you do. I hope you thank Him for it every night or every day or whatever, however often you're praying. I hope you pray and you thank Him for it every day. But if you don't, at least once a week, we're compelled to stop what we're doing and take that hour out of our lives and come here and say, I'm going to put everything else aside. I'm not going to think about whatever else that we're busy with doing. I'm just going to think about the death of Jesus for those few minutes. Because that's what the Lord asked me to do. And because I don't want to forget what He did for me. And I will forget if I don't take that time. The profound simplicity of the communion is something we talked about Wednesday night in the class. And I want to talk about it here for those that weren't here and to reflect on it a little more. The communion is so simple and yet so profound. It's simple because anybody can do it. Anybody can. It's not expensive to do. And even if you have no money, we share the elements with anybody. You don't have to. It doesn't cost you a dime. The poorest of the poor can do it. There's no cost to it. You don't have to build a gold-plated shrine. You don't have to pay for airline tickets to fly to some big location somewhere to bow down and remember Jesus in Jerusalem where He died or something. You don't have to do that. Nobody has to pay any big expense to remember Jesus. The bread and the fruit of the vine, that's all it takes. And that'll be supplied to you if you can't afford it. They're in the back. Anybody can have them. Anybody can do it. You can do it every week. And it's how Jesus wanted to be remembered. And it's so simple. And it's a memorial that disappears every time it's used. We consume the bread. We consume the fruit of the vine. And it's gone. There's no shrine. There's nothing to bow down to. There's no idol. There's no image. There's no picture of Jesus that somebody drew. That's what Jesus looked like. Nobody knows what Jesus looked like. Doesn't matter what He looked like. What matters is to remember His body and His blood. And those simple elements do that. But then they disappear, so you have to come back next week and do it again. And do it again and do it again. That's by design. The communion proclaims our faith. The communion is one of the ways, not the only way by any means, but it's one of the ways that we tell the world, I'm a Christian and I trust Jesus for my salvation. Paul says in verse 26, as often as you eat this bread and drink this cup, you proclaim the Lord's death till He comes. You're telling, you're proclaiming it. You're saying something about yourself when you show up here and you worship and you break that bread and drink that cup. You're telling people, I believe in Jesus. Jesus died for me and I trust Him for my salvation. Or not. If we don't show up to break bread in His memory, then what does that say about our faith? It proclaims that we don't believe in Him. It proclaims that we don't care that He died for us. If we neglect the communion and don't participate in it, then it proclaims our lack of faith. I'm not showing up to do that. The communion proclaims our present faith. It also projects our future faith in what's happening in the future. It means that we believe He's coming again. There was a gentleman in the church we attended in France who was a big, big guy. His family was immigrants from Haiti. He was a big black guy. Gentle guy, just the nicest guy you'd ever want to meet. And he talked about growing up attending church regularly. And he gave a talk at the Lord's Supper one time. And he said, when I was a kid growing up, he said, used to attend, and I'd watch him do the Lord's Supper. And he said, out there on the front of the table, it said, until He comes. He said, I always wondered, well, who's coming and when's He going to get here? why didn't He hurry up? He figured out later what it meant. But the point is that the Lord's Supper is a forward-looking practice as much as it is backward-looking. We're looking back at the cross, but we're also saying, Lord, when are You coming? We're looking forward to You coming. We're going to keep doing this until He comes because we believe He's coming. we didn't think he was coming, well, then why do it? But are we focused on his coming? Are we thinking, yes, Lord, I'm ready for you to come? And the Lord's Supper is an opportunity for us to take that self-reflection and say, am I ready for him to come? Or am I worried that he might come and I'm not prepared to meet him? I'll talk about that a little more in a minute. It expresses our faith in what he did and expresses our faith in what he will do. And as he will come back to redeem us. Faith is the substance of things hoped for. And it's an evidence or conviction of things not seen. Hebrews 11 and verse 1. I didn't see Jesus when he came and died on the cross. I have faith that he did, but I didn't see it. And I can't see how and when he's coming. I've been told about it in the scriptures, but I haven't seen it. Can't see it. It's off in the future. So those are two things that I believe by faith, but I can't see either one of them. But I have to trust them by faith, and I proclaim that faith every time I break bread in the communion. The next issue Paul addresses is eating it in a worthy manner. Therefore, whoever eats this bread or drinks this cup of the Lord in an unworthy manner will be guilty of the body and blood of the Lord. But let a man examine himself, and so let him eat of the bread and drink of the cup. For he who eats and drinks in an unworthy manner eats and drinks judgment to himself, not discerning the Lord's body. This goes back to what I said a few moments ago about the sacred and the secular. The communion is a time to put aside. Our entire worship is a time to do that, but in this context, he's talking specifically about the communion. It's a time to put aside all other considerations, and that's not easy. I know how hard it is. It's hard for me. I find myself having to slap myself mentally and get myself back in line because there's so many things going on, and I know you all may have that. I can't speak for you, but I think we all have to struggle with that sometimes. There's a lot going on in life. There's challenges, there's struggles, there's sickness, there's economic challenges, there's travel, there's loved ones that may have having problems or whatever it is, our jobs, our schools, our families. Those things intrude upon our thoughts. And it may be as simple as the ball game that's coming up or where we're going to eat dinner or is Aunt Susie still mad at me over the flowers I gave her? Whatever it is, that's invading our minds and our thoughts. And Paul says we've got to focus on the body and blood of the Lord. The question Jesus asked the apostles, the three that came with him further into the garden on the night he was betrayed, it kind of echoes down through the centuries. Couldn't you watch and pray with me just for an hour? Couldn't you? I think that's what Jesus asks of us during that time period of the Lord's Supper. Can't you just watch and pray with me for a little while? Can't you just put away all that other stuff for just a little while and watch and pray? We can. Holy things should be treated in a holy way. The time that we spend here in worship and the time particularly that we spend in breaking of bread is holy, it's sacred, and it's dedicated to the memory of Jesus. And that's all we should be concerned with during that time period. Everything else has to go away. And there's serious consequences if we don't, right? Paul says you're going to have judgment put upon you. You're going to eat and drink judgment unto yourself if we don't discern the Lord's body. And then he reaches this conclusion in verse 30. For this reason, many are weak and sick among you, and many sleep. And I think Jeff's translation said that they were even dying. And that's one of the possible interpretations of that word sleep, that some were dying. I don't know how figuratively or literally to take that, and if they were dying spiritually or if some were actually cursed with some form of sickness or even death. Some believe that. I don't know the answer, but I know whatever was going on, it wasn't good, and you don't want it. And this, Paul's trying to get them to realize how important the Lord's Supper is to their spiritual well-being, that this is an anchor that ties us to Christ, and we dare not neglect it. And we dare not treat it in an unworthy manner. We need to treat it with the dignity and the solemnity that it deserves. It's a weekly moment of silence. Let me tell you a little story. Years ago, I worked for a small defense contractor in northern Alabama. they had some equipment and materials left over from a project that had come and gone before I started working for them. But they showed me around the office when the first day that I went in to work there. And back in the back room somewhere, they had this room set up that they had used for some kind of defense contract. And it was like a special room within a room, kind of a rectangular, not very big. And they said, "Here, come on in here. I want to show you something." So we went inside, and it had all these strange, like foam cones all along the ceiling and the side, everywhere. And Jeff knows where I'm going with this. You've probably seen one. And they said, "Come on inside and shut the door." And we went inside that room, and when they shut that door, it was absolute silence. It was a silent room for some kind of scientific testing. And I've never been in, if you've never been in absolute silence, you don't know what it is. Because right now, if I stop talking, it's not silent. You can hear equipment running. You can hear the electric humming. You can hear the projector humming. You can hear the high-pitched whine of internet signals or electricity or whatever it is. There is no silence anymore. But when you step in that room, it was absolute silence. And it was kind of a refreshing break from the normal course. I mean, you can't find absolute silence. But my point here is that we live in a world that has forgotten what silence is. And I don't just mean the hum of electricity and stuff. I mean telephones and televisions and things going off and signaling and beeping and interrupting us all the time. There's always noise going, cars driving by and everything else. We almost have sensory overload, if that's the word for it. I don't know. We need that moment of silence, folks. We need to just turn all that off. Turn off the noise of the world and just talk to Jesus for that time period. In a few moments, Mike's going to lead us in the communion. And one of the things that the elders want you to think about is we want to encourage the men that are leading the communion. He's going to do this morning. Is just take a few extra moments of silence during the communion to stretch it out a little bit and give people time to have those moments of silence to commune with Jesus, to meditate on what he did, so that we're not rushing through it. And so we take that silence that we just don't have out there in the secular world. Maybe we can find it here. It's critical to our spiritual health. We've got to have it. And during that time period, we use that time also to judge ourselves. Let me ask you this. I don't know. I see some of these YouTube videos I have running in the background, so I don't have silence while I'm working. And some of these, they have some of these court videos. You ever see those where they have some angry judge or whatever, and some lying defendant? It's kind of crazy stuff goes on, and the judge will yell at them. And different judges have different styles. And a lot of times, sometimes you'll see a defendant who wishes he could have a different judge because this judge's angry at him, because he's got 16 violations and whatever, and he can't figure out why the judge is mad at him. He's there for the 17th time on something, but. Who do you want to judge you? That's a question I think that Paul asks here, in the sense that during the communion, well, look at what he says. For if we would judge ourselves, we would not be judged. Well, that's interesting. What he's getting at, I think, is the idea that during the communion, spend a few minutes judging yourself. So that whatever's going on in your life, if there are things you need to fix, you can fix them. And you don't have to face the ultimate judge with those things, right? We can get those things fixed now with his help, of course. But if we judge ourselves, what am I doing in my life? Is my life what it ought to be? And what if I don't feel right with God? Well, this would be a good time to get that fixed, wouldn't it? This would be a good time to meditate on how can I serve Jesus better? Judge yourselves so that you don't have to be judged later by the Lord. And, God forbid, verse 32, that we may not be condemned with the world. This is my opportunity to judge myself and see, if I'm acting like the rest of the world, I'm going to end up like the rest of the world. That is, lost. And the communion is a good time for me to reflect on myself and say, what do I need to do to make sure that doesn't happen to me? Judge yourself so that you won't be judged later on. Let's use the communion the way the Lord wanted us to. Let's make sure that it's a memorial to Him. Let's make sure that it's an expression of our faith. Let's make sure that it's a time of reflection, a time of silence, a time when we choose the holy over the secular, a time that we dedicate to Jesus, a time when we renew our strength and our faith, and a time when we judge ourselves, lest we be judged later on. Let's take a moment in prayer. If you would.